morning, Kirsten. What's going on this morning over there?
Good morning, Justin.
What's with the leather chair? How come you got this brand new spanking leather office chair? I'm sitting here in this moth-ridden, falling apart, rusty.
I like the feel of leather.
That's a.
I don't know.
It's a new chair.
It looks like a new chair.
It's
maybe
a
it
new
was,
chair in the
maybe
basement.
Maybe it was stolen
KDS.
From like
I
the.
Think so.
Maybe it was stolen from the newspaper.
Yeah, I think they took it from one of the other departments down here
I
in the dungeon.
So.
Snuck it over in the dead of night. No way they'd give us a new chair.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they thought that we deserved it.
Wow.
I don't know. I complain enough about like not being able to reach the microphone sometimes.
You look way more professional. You know, it's all the chair. It doesn't matter how you accessorize yourself.
With my silver sparkly shoes.
It's not the shoes.
No.
It's the chair you sit in that really says everything about you.
It says it all,
yeah.
Right?
You could be dressed to the nines, but if you're sitting in some like metal fold-out chair, it just kind of says something about where you are in life.
Welcome to This Week in Science. We are here for the next hour to talk about all the science news going on in this world and beyond. We've got all sorts of stories. All sorts of heavy science stories here. We've also got an interview at 9 o'clock. Bjorn Brems.
Oh, yay. Yes.
Who is actually...
Who memed us.
He
memchined us.
Memchined us?
Memchined us in an article.
That's right. Anyway, he studies neurobiology. He's at the Free University of Berlin, I believe. And he has done some interesting studies with fruit flies. We're going to talk with him about free will and fruit flies. Instead of free willy, it's free fruit fly. So that's at 9 o'clock. Aside from that, we've got all sorts of stories. Let me think if I've got any announcements. Nothing more than the usual. If you want to be a Twist tributor, send me a Twist tribution. 90 seconds or less to Kirsten at thisweekinscience.com. Unicorn Museum billboard. I've got 3 entries so far. I'm going to try and put them up on the website for voting this week. If you have a billboard entry, send it on. Send it on. I'll get it up there on the website so that we can like all decide. One person went so far as to create an entire Unicorn Museum website.
Wow.
That's
sweet.
Yeah. So we actually... Since he purchased that website, or not purchased that website, he created
Built
a website.
With his own bare hands.
I believe that we just bought unicornmuseum.org.
Nice.
Twist now owns.
Taking over.
Twist now owns unicornmuseum.org.
And
there'll be something coming there pretty soon.
I've got my unicorn, my contact in the unicorn world who's going to give us the lowdown.
That's right.
Some good photos behind the scenes there.
We better get
also,
some of that.
Also, a little bit of business still. Justin is still looking for a volunteer, a French maid, uniform required, help around my new farmhouse. And actually looking for somebody who does speak French and can teach me.
He can teach you French well.
While organizing the... And it's just some light unpacking, building some furniture, and dusting. You know, the normal stuff.
Yeah. I'm still looking for an intern. Everyone who wants to take me up on it is not local.
That's the problem with being international.
I know.
Is that, like,
but if you're in the local area for the
Scotland,
summer and you want some experience
maid,
if you want some experience in the radio world and you're interested in the web, new media format, and you want to help out on... spreading the science word.
Isn't there some
intern
way
you could, with me?
But isn't there a way we could like have an intern that telecommutes through the internet? There's got to be a way to do that, Kirsten.
There probably is.
We'll just outsource it. We'll just get an intern in like
look
some third
to,
world country.
I'm trying
like,
to you know be
UK
into helping the local community and like that kind of a thing right now. You know, it's all local.
Canada.
At local.
How about Canada?
Help global. Whatever it is. What is it?
What are you talking about?
Never mind.
You gotta solve all the problems of the world first so that our local area will be better.
Right. Well, it turns out that researchers at Wake Forest University are trying to figure out the marital problems of boobies.
Oh, I love the boobies. They're my favorite bird.
Yes. In this case, researchers were looking at Nazca boobies that live off the coast of Ecuador in the Galapagos Islands.
Wow.
Yes. Turns out these boobies there are more males than females in the population by about 50%. So,
wow,
the females, they kind of get wandering eye.
Oh.
And tend to take off on their quote-unquote marriages.
Non-monogamous boobies.
Very non-monogamous boobies, definitely. What the researchers found and published in the June 13th issue of Proceedings of the Royal Society B Biological Sciences is that these boobies tend to break up with their mates, file for divorce, head on out and get themselves a younger man when, after raising a child with their current mate, the male looks a little haggard and worn out. So if your mate's not, if in this population, if a woman's mate isn't up to snuff and can't, like, maintain his youthful vigor and his, his handsome allure, then she's like, I'm off. I'm going to get someone younger. You're like 40. I'm going after a 20-year-old.
Hey, whoa, back off on actually putting an age on women.
But, you know, that's 40. Not.
Come on. Ouch.
The researchers say the study really predicts that the probability of divorce increases with the bird's success at breeding and raising a chick because the effort required may tire out the male and consequently his mate may reject him. It also shows that mates of this species are never permanently in or out of the mating game, in contrast to many other animals. So lots of other mammals are animals are fairly monogamous or really not monogamous. But this species seems kind of plays the line between being.
Well, if you reverse the genders and change the species to humans, it kind of sounds like the pattern that we can see all around us.
And it's really interesting. As I was reading the article, I was wondering, you know, so in our population, we have relatively even numbers of males and females, with maybe slightly more females than males. Not that much more, but very slightly. And so what would happen?
Those are just the really hot, unattainable females.
Exactly. What would happen if suddenly our population had way more males than it does right now?
Ugh.
So that there was a glut of males in the population, and females really could be the choosy sex and pick whoever they wanted. Would our behavior change to match the new population frequencies? So would the behavior of females and males actually alter if we did have some kind of an adjustment to the numbers of the different sexes? Because that seems to be the case in this population, that because there are so many males, it makes it easy for the females I'll go get another one.
One place you can study that. Well, there's got to be a population by population. You could find towns that are completely out of whack one way or the other. Like Alaska, areas of Alaska where there are...
Well, there's way more males.
Very few females. Many men.
Yeah.
That's true. Probably take a look at the mating behaviors of the Alaskan female hominoid. And, you know, probably maybe she's playing the field.
Yeah. Do females become more promiscuous?
Yeah.
It's a good question.
It is.
I find it fascinating. Sexual behavior in all animals is just interesting. What makes animals decide to be the
naughty.
Way they... It's not naughty.
It's naughty.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's just what makes them decide to stick with one mate versus not sticking with a mate. And with this, the booby population, they do stick with their mate for the duration of chick rearing. So they will mate with a male. They will raise that young over a period of about 4 months that it takes to rear the young to independence. And then they might stay with him, and they might not.
Yeah.
It's kind of up in the air at that point.
Yeah.
You know, but they do stay together for the duration of one breeding interval.
Well, that's nice.
So
and,
that's
you know,
good.
When your breeding interval is like 4 months, I guess that's not too much of a commitment to really, you know. 4 months, we got to raise the kids, get them through school, off to college. 4 months, yeah, I'll stay around for that.
Good. I'm glad you would, Justin.
So I've got, like, I'm science light today, but I found something on thescotsman.com that's just a bunch of silly questions that science has attempted to answer. One of them, you know, elephants don't like walking up hills. Apparently, this is something that's been observed in the migration of elephants, is they avoid stretches where there's mountainous regions.
Well, have you ever heard of, like, the mountain elephant?
No.
No.
But then I'm also thinking, like, okay, well, elephants don't like walking up hills, but, like, neither do I. Like, who does? Like, billy goats and, like, snow leopards or something, you know?
Very agile creatures.
Yeah, there's, like, a couple that live in them. Pretty much nobody else is, like, running around looking to climb up hills. But they did conclude that elephants climbing 100 meters burn energy that would take an extra half hour of foraging to replace. So the expenditure of energy would be so massive for something like an elephant to be climbing up a hill that it was just completely inefficient to do so, even if it meant walking long distances to get around.
It's better to go around than to go up.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Just like, you know, that's the way I tackle a lot of problems, too, in life, is that if you just avoid
just
them. Just go around. Just go around the problem.
Yeah, that sounds totally healthy.
Woodpeckers. Woodpeckers, it's been theorized, don't get headaches from all that head banging that goes on. Ivan Schwab, the University of California, reached the final of the, he got the Ig Nobel Awards given annually by Harvard University for weird research for his paper on how woodpeckers avoid headaches. His research, published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology.
What?
I can't tell, my printer, like, half, like, missed the word there.
Great.
But anyway, he studied head injuries of woodpeckers dating back to the 70s. The pilcated woodpecker engages in repetitive headbanging for much of the day, an intensity that would leave human beings with serious brain and eye injuries. The woodpecker survives unscathed because of adaptations in the anatomy of its skull that offer protection. The answer lies in how woodpecker's skull and brain are arranged, and muscles around sensitive brain tissue made the woodpecker's head function like a perfect shock absorber. I can picture future NFL, like children of NFL players, having these sorts of adaptations if they stay in the sport for years and years and years. Because there's a lot of headbanging that goes on in there.
It would be adaptive. It definitely would.
Goodness.
I mean, they're finding out right now there are a lot of issues with depression that are affecting professional football players more than other sports and more than the general population. So that it seems that the amount of concussions that these athletes gain from their sport, it's definitely impairing them as they get older.
Oh yeah, no, especially when you start hearing a list of injuries of a professional athlete, like broke this, sprained that, had to have this tendon replaced. Oh, and concussions? Yeah, I'm still under a dozen. I'm good to play. What? Half of all women make their minds up within 30 seconds of meeting a man whether or not he's worth dating. 30 seconds? Researchers,
What, you think that's impossible?
No, I just thought it was quicker than that. I always thought it was about 3 seconds. Just try to make my first impression in 3 seconds, and there no reaction. All right, never mind.
Yep.
Researchers led by Professor Richard Wiseman of Hertfordshire, University, highlighted the importance of chat-up lines. Top road of Casanova line apparently being if you were... If you weren't... Whatever. This is just silly. But basically, I would think that it would happen quick. 30 seconds is a really long time, if you think about it.
It's a pretty long
stretch. I would think the first 3 seconds would be the real crucial time frame. But if you get a whole 30 seconds to
3 seconds is like turning around, seeing somebody, and maybe shaking their
first
hand
impression.
Or saying hi. Totally first
Boom.
Impression.
First
yeah.
impression. And based on your story last week, does he look like my daddy or does he not look like my daddy? Like, that would take care of that first 3 seconds.
Are you my daddy?
Would take care of so much of it.
The answer is no. It turns out that human interaction increases the cognitive abilities of monkeys.
They're learning from us.
They're learning from us. Researchers from Chimpanzee Cognition Center at The Ohio State University, publishing in the journal Animal Cognition, raised 3 groups of monkeys with differing amounts of human interaction and environmental stimulation and tested them on their abilities to solve a task using a simple tool. The three groups consisted of one with a history of long-term stable social interaction with humans that they called enculturated. A group also was raised in a sanctuary setting that only had caretaker contact with humans. This is termed semi-enculturated. And a third group was raised under laboratory captive conditions that they called laboratory chimpanzees. And those monkeys didn't really have much of any interaction with humans. They gave the monkeys access to a firm-headed rake and a flimsy-headed rake, the one that was kind of floppy,
yeah,
that didn't really work to rake anything up.
I don't like the
up.
Floppy things.
We don't like, we know that the firm rake is good for,
yeah,
picking things up off the ground, moving them around and that kind of stuff. But would a monkey be able to pick up on that? If they both look like rakes with all sorts of little fingers going out, spreading out, would they know which one to use to grab something like a food reward that they want? And that's the question that these researchers went after. And they found out that the monkeys in the enculturated and semi-enculturated groups, the ones that had had either lots of contact with humans or had interaction with a caretaker, were most likely to use the firm-headed rake to retrieve a food reward. Then the researchers presented the monkeys with two hybrid rakes that had a firm side and a floppy side, so that they were like half and half.
Just one depending side was firm, on how you turned it, that's how the rake would operate.
Exactly. And so one rake, they left firm side down, and the other rake was firm side up. And then just within the reach of the rake, they put a food reward, and they let the monkeys use the rakes to try and retrieve the food reward. And if the monkeys understood the physical properties of the firm rake versus the floppy rake as opposed to just rakeness, then they should choose the rake that was firm-headed side down to be able to grab the food more often. And they found that only the monkeys in the enculturated group, or the one that had the most contact with humans, seemed to choose the rake with the firm side down. The semi-enculturated monkeys chose randomly between the two, so they just had some idea of rakeness, but they didn't actually understand the physical properties of the firm versus the flimsy materials that were used. The laboratory monkeys that didn't have human contact really at all failed both tests. And according to Dr. Sarah Boyson, who led the study, she said, "We think our findings mean that the conditions under which chimpanzees are raised, housed, and maintained have long-term effects on their cognitive development and offer direct comparisons with early experience, issues of attachment, and preschool education for human infants and children." The authors conclude that the differences in performance between the three groups are directly attributable to the significant effect of level of enculturation, and that enculturated chimpanzees may be better at learning within a highly social interactive context because they have heightened attention to the actions of others.
Wow.
Yeah. So maybe they're paying it because of the interaction with humans. They're like somehow paying attention to things more, and somehow they're learning more from humans than they would otherwise.
I wonder if they think they're going to grow up and be people one day.
I don't know.
You know?
I want to grow up and be just like that guy with the rake.
Yeah. When am I going to get to have, you know, show other monkeys how to use rakes? It's got to be coming someday.
Yep.
So we've been out there doing stuff on the space station.
Yeah.
Unfolding this solar wing or retracting it, doing all this stuff out there.
Trying
computer
to fix
glitches
the outside of the shuttle fuel.
All kinds of stuff going out there. But
they've had like four spacewalks in a week.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And this is, they were, let's see, last Wednesday they were 206 miles above Eastern Europe. Wow. That's pretty far. It's not far if you're driving, but I guess that's the thing.
If you're up
in space,
up,
that's a ways up. Just a little note out of all of this that just made me laugh when I was reading through all the... There's an astronaut we've got up there, Forrester, who's been involved in retracting, folding up one of the solar wings, because I guess they didn't automatically retract properly, so we had to go out there and wiggle some stuff around out there. This is in one of the news reports from the spacewalk. Forrester struggled with a difficult bolt at one point, telling Mission Control, "I'm giving everything I have, and it's just not coming." A few minutes later, Mission Control gave some advice that worked. "So you're saying that's lefty, loosey, righty, tighty?" Copy that.
Are you kidding?
No. Well, they don't go into saying exactly why the bolt came loose, but it's just, I think that's what's hinted. After a few minutes, Mission Control gave advice that worked on the bolt. What else could it be? No, hit it with a hammer? No, I think you might have been turning it the wrong way. But it gets confusing in space, because they also explained working on the space station as sort of akin to being on working on a moving Ferris wheel in space, where everything is constantly moving around as you're up there.
Everything's spinning around, and
you can
have
hear
to
that
somehow
music
keep
in the
your
background.
No.
I guess you can't get space sick in one of those spacewalk uniforms. That would be so nasty.
Well, if you did, that would be a problem.
Oh man. That's why they make sure that they make them puke all the time when they're on the ground, like spinning them around. No, they do. That's like part
During
of
the
astronaut training.
You mean.
Yeah. Part of astronaut training is getting you used to like throwing up to the point where you're just not nauseous anymore. For any reason.
Well, it's not that you get used to throwing up. It's just that you get used to the feeling of being disoriented so you don't throw up.
Anymore.
I mean, if they were trying to make them throw up and get used to the feeling of throwing up, they'd be 1, 2, stick your finger down your throat.
Yeah, they'd have a bunch of bulimic
astronauts. On the count
of
3.
Right.
Yeah, no, I don't see them lining up and like puking into bowls on purpose. I mean, that's just not, no, that's not part of the training. Oh, my goodness.
I still want to go to space camp someday.
Oh, you can. There's an adult space camp out there.
I know.
In physics news, researchers have discovered the greatest ice cream cone ever. No. Well, it's what they call the triple scoop baryon.
Triple scoop baryon.
Triple scoop
baryon. That sounds
baryon. It's been discovered by researchers of the D0 experiment at the Department of Energy's Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. They discovered this baryon particle after sifting through data from trillions of collisions that were produced over the last 5 years to identify the collision's final decay products. The physicists have detected 19 of these specific candidate events to produce this particular baryon particle, and the odds of the observed signal being due to something other than what they think it is are estimated to be 1 in 30 million. So the odds are pretty good that what they think this baryon particle is actually what it is. So a baryon is a particle of matter that's made up of 3 fundamental building blocks that are called quarks, and quarks are the very basic particles of matter. The most familiar baryons are protons and neutrons of the atomic nucleus, and they consist of up and down quarks. Baryons composed of heavier quarks were abundant very soon after the beginning of the universe, after the time of the Big Bang, whereas now protons and neutrons are much more abundant, and they're made up of lighter quarks. So there's this basis of like how heavy the particles within the protons and neutrons or the whatever baryon you're talking about, how heavy are they? That determines kind of like how old it is and what era of the universe it probably was very abundant during. So the standard model of physics summarizes the basic building blocks of matter. And the basic building blocks come in 3 distinct families of quarks and their sister particles, the leptons. The first family contains the up and down quarks. Heavier quarks are the charm and strange quarks that make up the second family. And the very heaviest quarks are the top and bottom quarks that make up the third family. And all of these quarks usually get bound together by what's called the strong force. And the strong force holds them together into the larger particles that they create. And so this new baryon fills in a missing space in the standard model. It is composed of one particle from each, one kind of quark from each of the 3 different families. They're calling it Cascade B, and the other name for it is Xi sub B baryon. It's easier to say Cascade B, I think. But it's made up of a down quark, a strange quark, and a bottom quark. And it's the first observed baryon formed of quarks from all three families of matter. Hmm. They've always thought that it would be, that it would exist, but they've never been able to find it or actually isolate it. And this is the first time that they've done that. So it kind of, when researchers find things like this and isolate these particles, it just verifies aspects of the standard model of what we expect it matter. We expect matter to be made up of certain things, and for it to have, for there to be certain particles in existence or to have been in existence during certain phases of our universe's evolution.
And it's a good point just about science in general, like that that so much of science is verifying what things like I thought were already like, well, that's science, and that science just believes this and goes forward. Like relativity. It's like, oh, I thought Einstein, we just figured out that Einstein was right all right a long time ago, mm-hmm. and we just moved forward with that. But no, there's still like studies going on that are proving Einstein's work, because it's all about, we're still verifying everything that we kind of know and move forward with.
Exactly.
But we still go back and verify and make sure the basis, and we're doing it also in the quantum and with the quarks and the things and the stuff. It's so much, because it's like, okay, well, what's the next step? No. We're still on the first step.
We're still verifying this stuff.
What we know, mm-hmm. making sure what we know is actually works in the physical world.
Exactly. Yeah. Because there is always the possibility that something in one of our hypotheses isn't quite right, that mm-hmm. there is some other explanation. And so we have to cross out all of those alternative possibilities before we can get down to the one truth.
Right. Which is why.
So science is all about disproving hypotheses.
Which is, if you have a 100 hypotheses and you go and explore all of them and all of them are completely wrong, it doesn't mean you're a bad scientist. It means you've added 100, you've crossed off 100 dead ends that somebody else doesn't have to travel down later.
Right.
It's awesome. It's always a win. All research is a win.
Totally win-win.
Always.
Win-win.
So this is a story that's been, like, I've been kind of hanging on to it. This is a Life Science for LifeScience.com from a little while ago. But it's our it's got one of our previous guests in it.
Nice.
It's the fossilized dinosaurs. It looks like, seem to have this wide open mouth, head thrown back, tails curved toward the head posture that we've seen many, many times. Paleontologists have long assumed that a lot of these dinosaurs died in waters and that currents had drifted them around, which I thought was weird, because I know that while we find some dinosaurs that, you know, were died in rivers and that sort of thing, it always seemed like it had to be mudslide or something else involved
that,
with it.
That's quick, that like covered them up really fast.
Yeah, because how do you get fossilized, you know? I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. I've never tried it. Maybe it's easier than I think. But or maybe it was just that rigor mortis, drying muscle and tendons pulled them into those positions. Ligaments contorting limbs, that sort of thing.
Right, well, you'd think that maybe during the process of fossilization, since things are being desiccated, mm-hmm. as opposed to if things remained moist, then they wouldn't tighten up so much. But
there
if desiccation is taking place, things are going to shorten. And so if they do shorten muscles of the necks, you would expect some kind of a back turning of the head. And
so I'm reading this in the literature, quote voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading this in the literature and thinking, this doesn't make any sense to me as a veterinarian. Said, oh, wait, I got the wrong name. Cynthia Marshall it's Fox or Faux. I can never tell when they put the X in there and how you're supposed to pronounce it. But this is a veterinarian turned paleontologist at the Museum of the Rockies. Faux and her colleagues say, or I'm going to call her Fox just because I don't have it right. Fox and her colleagues said brain damage. Say brain damage and asphyxiation are the most likely culprits for these strange positions. Classic example of the posture, which has puzzled paleontologists somewhat over the years, is 150-million-year-old Archaeopteryx. First known example of a feathered dinosaur and proposed link between the dinosaur and the present-day Tweety birds. Virtually all articulated specimens of Archaeopteryx are in this posture, exhibiting a classic pose of the head thrown back, jaws open, back and tail reflexed backwards, and limbs contracted, said our friend, Kevin Padian, professor of integrative biology and curator of the Museum of Paleontology at the University of California, Berkeley. Oh, finally, look, halfway through the article, they explain that Fox is pronounced Fox. Thank you. Halfway, you could start with that, whoever, life science people. So they published their findings this week, or this is probably a couple weeks ago in the Journal of Paleobiology. So some animals found this posture may have suffocated in ash during a volcanic eruption, consistent with the fact that many fossils are found in ash deposits, which makes good sense. Other possibilities exist. There could be disease, brain trauma, that sort of thing. But the asphyxiation, it's also because this posture has been seen not only in dinosaurs, but in mammals, which are known to suspected have had high metabolic rates. And it appears to be a good indicator that the animal was warm-blooded, as other research has suggested. So, yeah, warm-blooded dinosaurs, which we know, their temperatures actually, the only thing that limited the size of the dinosaurs was that their temperatures would cook them internally once they got to a certain size.
Yeah.
They couldn't down-regulate like we could, but they were definitely hot, hot-blooded. Animals with lower metabolic rates, such as crocodiles, lizards, use less oxygen, and so may not have been as traumatically affected by hypoxia during death throes. So.
Interesting.
Dinosaurs died horrible deaths, and that's why they look like it.
That sounds really terrible.
Yeah.
Well, we have to take a station break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Bjorn Brems, Doctor of Neurobiology at Free University in Berlin. So stay tuned. Are you an extreme tinkerer? Want to know how to make pulse jets, spud guns, or even a steam-powered cannon designed by Leonardo da Vinci? Whoosh Boom Splat, The Garage Warrior's Guide to Building Projectile Shooters, the newest book by William Gerstel, the ultimate garage warrior, is available now at www.whooshboomsplat.net. The reading. We have Dr.
Bjorn Brems.
Yes, he is a neurobiologist at the Free University Berlin.
Free University.
And we need to know exactly when World Robot Domination is coming, as based on his research. So without further ado, let's bring him on the line.
Bjorn Brems, welcome to This Week in Science.
Thank you.
And thank you. Ah, what was that? I'm hitting bells and things. Thank you right off the bat for the mention. And you were interviewed by the
Charles Choi
of Life Science.
Yeah.
And you mentioned one of the aspects of your research could be world robot domination.
Robot domination.
Nice.
That's right.
Couldn't help it. I hear it all the time, so I had no idea he would pick up on it.
So great.
Well, it's such a catchphrase. You know it.
I got a flood of emails linking to the story. Like, what? What? Is this? What's going on?
Yeah, like I said, I wrote it as a joke, and I just thought, you know, that's something that he could think of, you know, to have an idea of what this might lead to. I didn't think he would, you know,
actually use it.
Take the whole phrase out of it.
So now we get at the basic question of how on earth would fruit fly research lead to world robot domination? How could your research help us make the advanced robots that will somehow take over?
So what we found was that these animals, even in the complete absence of any environment to speak of, they still perform turning maneuvers that seem to be optimal for finding things. And these sort of maneuvers, these search strategies or similar ones, have been found in basically everywhere one has looked, from plankton to monkeys, albatrosses, or anything. And nobody had any idea how these strategies arise. But apparently a large portion of it is programmed into the brain. So if we could find out how the brain does it and program it into robots, then assuming that, you know, the few remaining humans are hiding somewhere randomly, then robots would be better at finding us if they had that strategy.
Right. So what?
Which I'm assuming, I'm hoping that the reason you're exploring this is so if we know what their strategy is, we can then counter with an evasion of our own. Hopefully, that's. But how do you actually get to witness free will and a fruit fly?
Well, I don't really think you can witness free will in a fruit fly. I think everybody can only witness free will in his own mind. I think it's really hard to tell that, for you to tell that I have free will and the other way around.
Right. So it's that question of I think therefore I am.
Well, just complete.
But you can't ever say that about anybody else, because maybe everyone else is a construct of your own mind. That
exactly.
It comes back down to that.
No. It doesn't. Not that one. It doesn't come down to that question. But it does come down to the question: does anybody but me exist? I don't think it goes that far. But I think it does say, like, what is free will versus what have we been conditioned to do?
Exactly.
I mean, is the experiences that we've seen, do they just basically line up? If any other body brain got slapped down and had my, you know, got sent down the causeway of my life, would they end up at the same destination?
That's a very good way of putting it. And so what I was referring to earlier, just before, was that this philosophical notion of free will, saying that, well, we're thinking, and how can our thinking have some impact on the physical world? And this sort of implies that there is some independent thinking of the physical world, which, of course, if we're biologists, we don't really assume, because we think, well, all our thinking is brain activity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, you look at actions of a brain, and you wonder, as you just said, is that action that I'm observing, is that determined? And that's basically what most of biology, of behavioral neurobiology, is about. Is that, okay, I want to find out how the brain does it, and if I know how it does it, then I can predict when and where a certain behavior is occurring.
Do we
have? And what our study showed was that for individual animals and individual behaviors, this sort of predictability is very hard to achieve. In some behaviors you can do it, but in others it's really, really difficult.
Did you get any idea from your studies of the fruit flies as to what percent of their activity is internally mediated and what percent is based on external stimulation?
I'd love to know that. That'd be something. We've been trying to get to some quantifications, but we haven't been able to do this. What we've been trying to quantify was how much does the noise in the brain, so how much do, you know, variability in vesicle fusion, in fluctuations of membrane potentials or something like that, how much does that sort of system noise contribute to the overall variability, which is sort of a related question. And we haven't really gotten anywhere yet. Mm. And but in order to find out the percentage, you know, environmentally triggered behavior compared to endogenously generated behavior, one would have to study a lot and a lot and a lot of behaviors and then quantify the variability That I would love to do that. That'd be great. That'd be a great thing to do.
It just seems like you picked such a hard, like a fly. Like, I know humans were too complicated to get to separate the noise and the will from the conditioning. That we got too much going on. A fly might just be too small. Isn't there something bigger, maybe even dumber than a fly that you could be looking at?
Well, another animal that I study is are snails.
Mm.
So they're larger.
Yeah.
Whether you'd call them dumber or not, I guess depends on your perspective. Surely they have a lot less of behavioral options.
Yeah.
If you look at a slug, and, well, we use the marine slug, aplysia.
Yeah.
It certainly has fewer neurons. It certainly doesn't fly. Well, some aplysia species swim, but other than that, locomotion, feeding, and procreation is basically all they do. Mm. And if I can acquire funding, I would like to study that sort of, or do a similar study in the isolated brain of snails, where we can do some imaging and then maybe get to more physiologically to the brain and the circuits that generate behavior.
Can you give us some kind of a primer of what the basic paradigm you use for studying the behavior is?
So for the flies, mm-hmm. what we did was actually a very old experiment. So my thesis advisor, Martin Heisenberg, the youngest son of the uncertainty principle, mm-hmm. Heisenberg, he developed this. So this is an old school, actually, an old school of neurobiology. It originated somewhere in the 60s, and the main machine, the so-called torque meter that I'm using here, has an inventory sticker from 1963.
Wow.
And then as the decades go by, has new things added to it.
Right.
It's in the 60s and 70s people started to take Drosophila and also other flies and glue them to little hooks. And those hooks are comparatively light, so they can fly around with them and walk around with them. But we pick the hooks up and place those hooks in a clamp, and with them, the flies. And that clamp sticks in this torque meter that measures where the fly is trying to fly without actually the fly getting anywhere.
Hmm.
So it's flying stationarily, not turning, not moving up or down. All it's doing, you know, it can bend its abdomen, it's move its legs, its wings and everything, but it can't get anywhere. And what people have been doing in the 60s and 70s was basically cybernetics. They were treating them as input-output systems and then found the rules, how they steer, how they control course control, you know. And that's a fairly straightforward thing. And the idea was, well, those are simple brains, and if we can figure out how they work, then maybe we can get at the principle of how all brains work. And the cybernetic approach got very far. People know now very well how the course control system of the fly works, how they can fly a straight path and how they react to disturbances and all that. But very early in the, or after 10 or 20 years, so in the, well, let's say in the 80s, mid to late 80s, Martin Heisenberg put the flies into a completely white arena. And the idea was then, well, if the brain works like a cybernetic system, then this constant input or this non-input should be reflected by a constant or non-output.
Hmm.
And this wasn't at all what he found. So he found that the flies were doing all kinds of behaviors and turning left and turning right and do all kinds of things, even though nothing changed in the environment that would have triggered those behaviors.
Right. So there's no external stimulation, nothing.
No
telling
researcher
them.
Walking in with a fly swatter.
Yeah.
Going, I'm gonna. No, I'm just okay.
Yeah. So, no, so there should really have been no reason. They either should have been following one straight course, ideally, or not doing anything at all.
Well, would this be this in the non-input though? Would this be what's the closer to the programming that's like the natural search pattern, or is it further from it?
So that that search pattern is something that is not quite optimal if it's in this situation. If there's no environment there at all,
mm-hmm.
it's not as optimal as if you have the environment there. So the way I'm thinking this is working is that you have a sort of a basic pattern that then gets adjusted to whatever environment the fly has. You know, if there's a side wind, or if it's very dark, or if the visibility is very low, or something like that, then it adjusts the strategy so that on the one hand it finds food or whatever it's trying to find, mm-hmm. and on the other hand doesn't crash into things.
Yeah.
So maybe in the non-environment, the search, the pattern that's arriving is just the pattern that would be like, okay, find a landmark.
For example,
find something.
If the fly is flying in really poor visibility, it's not seeing anything.
Yeah.
This could be one thing that they're trying to do. So what this non-environment experiment did actually was that Mr. Heisenberg, he turned his career around 180 degrees. He stopped the cybernetics. He left the department. He founded his own department, got hired in a different university, and studied spontaneous behaviors and their effect and the consequences of behavior, which is operant conditioning, sort of like the Skinner box learning with the rats pressing the lever and then as a consequence of their behavior getting food. So this was a big turnaround point. So that's the experiment we used, and the data we got from this experiment we analyzed with a whole host of mathematical analyses, because one of the reasons one could say why the animals perform different behaviors and change all the time is not really that the brain is wired up to do all kinds of different things spontaneously, but this may simply just be noise in the same cybernetic system.
Right.
And this was a question that hadn't been really addressed in the last, you know, since it finally got published in 1991, maybe a little earlier than that. And nobody had looked at whether that was, you know, noise or whether that really there was really any clue, whether anyone could find a clue whether this comes really from the brain by design.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, right. So you're looking for some kind of a pattern within the behavior.
Right. So what one could think and what one can see immediately is that it's not rhythmic. So one could say, well, you know, I turn two times left, then I turn two times right, or then, you know, I fly 360-degree turn to the left and then 360-degree. So something, you know, something really stereotypical.
Yeah.
And that you just look at the data and you see it right away. That's not how it is. And then you do some analysis to see whether it's just something that, you know, looks random but isn't random, or, mm-hmm. you know, there's a whole bunch of things that mathematically you can do.
And so you ended up finding, let's see, what it was it there, that it matched with one particular algorithm called Levy's distribution. Now, can you tell what exactly is Levy's distribution and why did that make it something important or significant?
All right, so there's actually a whole bunch of things to say to that, and I'm going to try to reduce the number of things. So Levy's distribution means that it's compared to other distributions, it's so-called heavy tail distribution. So if you look at a exponential distribution, for example, this is what you would get for something that's purely random, sort of like, let's say, radioactive decay. Then you get an exponential distribution. A Levy distribution looks, if you look at it with a bare eye, it looks fairly similar. The only difference is that the tail end of it, where it tapers off against zero, is larger. So this means that if I look at the, for example, what we looked at was the interval between turns. Just look at how many seconds does it take from a left turn to the next left turn or the next right turn, whatever turn they're making. And then we plot how often are short inter-turn intervals and long inter-turn intervals. Then those long inter-turn intervals are more common than you would expect by pure chance. And what this does is that the animals start searching clustered, in a clustered way. So we make many short turns, then that means you turn around in the same spot. And then you make a long flight before the next turn. This means it brings you into a different area, and then you search again for a little while.
Right.
So you search effectively. What this means is that effectively you're searching in a larger area than if you would just search, you know, purely randomly. That's mm-hmm. what also has been shown in about 10 years ago, mathematically. And, however, the problem is this Levy distribution. There are so many different ways you can make a Levy distribution. And originally it was a If I understand that correctly, the original Levy flight or walk was a Markov process, which is also a sort of random process. And we found that while we can generate, with a Markov process, we can generate data that are Levy distributed, other characteristics do not match the flight data. So once we had that, first we were lucky, we were happy with, oh yeah, this is really nice, and a lot of people have written about those Levy distributions. But then we found, okay, we have to do much more than that. And eventually what we figured out was that it's not... an intermediate step was that there were... We tried... So I have to back up a little bit, otherwise it gets too long. This gets too complicated. So we had to find which of those many mechanisms that could generate a Levy distribution actually was responsible for the Levy distribution that the flies showed.
Mm. Okay.
And we ended up with a method that was used by ecologists. And that was George Sugihara and his graduate student. And those are the two middle authors in the paper. They helped us tremendously by implementing that method. And they fused their method to find out whether the fluctuations in species abundance in the sea, in the marine habitats, whether they are due to random fluctuations or due to interactions between the species.
Okay.
And this is exactly what we found as well. So we used this method to look at if our flies, you know, are mainly random or mainly due to so-called nonlinear interactions. And what we found was the same as they found for the marine species, that it's a nonlinear system, which is, in a nonlinear system, a good example for a nonlinear system is the weather, for example. It is deterministic in the way that it follows the laws of physics, obviously, but still is very hard to predict.
Right. So it, on some level, when you're just looking at it, it seems kind of random, but there's actually interaction on many complex levels that's affecting the way that the outcome occurs.
Right. And the cool thing, and why this made us think about free will in humans,
yeah,
was this this conundrum that always makes my head spin when I think about it, is that free will is an oxymoron when you say...
Uh-huh.
When you say it's supposed to be free, right? So it can't be deterministic, but we think that, you know, if you don't think about quantum mechanics, then usually much of our world we live in is deterministic. So how can it be free? And if it's not deterministic, it must be random. That's what you think. But if it's random, then it's not your will, right? If it's just mm-hmm. your behavior, it's just a random behavior, like in a seizure or something, then that's not you. That's not your will.
Right.
So it must, you know, what is it? It's, you know, it can't be one, it can't be the other. So the idea is, and mathematicians actually have known this for quite a long time, that there actually is something that's in between, or that you could describe in words as in between random and deterministic. And that's exactly those nonlinear systems. You can't really predict them, but still they obey the laws of physics, and they're not, you know, they're not supernatural or anything.
There's a personal experiment that I've done in my life. And it had to do with it's sort of deterministic free will, but I was trying to change the future, like on purpose, like with the idea
right.
that I was going to change the future of events as they unraveled before me. And you would do this every once in a while. You're on your way to work, you're driving there to work, and then you're like, all right, next exit. You take the next exit off the freeway or what have you. You drive around a neighborhood for about 5 minutes. You go back out, you see a couple new houses or new places or new things, get back on the freeway, then you go to work. Now, I've somehow, by altering the time I'm coming to work and the whole events that are going to unfold that day, to some degree have changed the future and expressed free will in doing so.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the nice thing about this is that where you take that exit and where you turn from that exit is not completely arbitrary.
Mm-mm.
Right? Because,
right.
you know, it depends on all kinds of things. It may seem to you that it's arbitrary, but I'm sure it depends on a whole lot of things, but they don't necessarily trigger that you go out at this exit. It's influence. So, of course, the famous example for those sort of voluntary movements is like lifting your arm. And of course, a right-hander will lift his arm more often lifts his right arm than the left arm.
Just did it.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's that exact same thing. It's influence, but it's not determined. So it's that thing that's halfway between completely arbitrary, completely random, and determined. So of course now we got with all the media coverage and stuff, we got of course people that saying, "Well, there you go, see, it's random." And then we got the other people that go, "Oh, see, it's deterministic. I told you from the beginning."
That's really funny. We're running out of time here at the very end of our show, but I just want to ask one really quick last question. I don't know if it will be really quick or not, but
we'll try.
So with this, do you think that you have shown that there is this basic neural capacity for what you call spontaneity, or this place between randomness and determinism, that can be extrapolated all the way up to the complex behaviors of humans?
Short answer, yes. Somewhat longer answer. I think we first need to study other animals a little bit more and other behaviors, and then see how the variability changes. There's a certain structure. The Levy structure is one of them that is common to a lot of animals. And there's some anatomical, just recently, I think you even reported about that, about the Orbilateria, the last common ancestor. It means that the basic wiring of brains in insects and vertebrates apparently seems to be conserved and derives from a common ancestor. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of reasons to think that what we found in the fly might actually be a common theme, that brains are made to constantly either generate or vary ongoing behavior.
Right.
And there's a couple of evolutionary reasons why this might be advantageous, the whole bunch. So for now, it would make a lot of sense if this were indeed the case.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. This has been really fun talking with you.
I'm gonna go drive randomly around, deterministically, to have free will, to change the future. I'm gonna take a little longer drive on my way to work today.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Good idea.
See what I can come up with as far as free will.
I'm gonna use my free will.
So little.
Take a nap. Anyway,
Dr. Bjorn Brems, thank you very much for joining us here on This Week in Science.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Yeah, good luck in the rest of your research, and have a great day.
Thank you. I'll be listening to you for the next, I don't know how long. As long as I'll be preparing my experiments, you'll be in my ear.
Awesome.
Great, thank you.
And remember, if you've learned anything from today's show,
it's all in your head.
Yes.